Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos raised eyebrows last week in her testimony when she testified about proposed funding cuts to the Special Olympics. President Trump later walked back that plan, but the controversy drew attention to the long-term funding issues for special education. New York Magazine Intelligencer staff writer Matthew Stieb covered DeVos's testimony last week. He joins us now by phone. Welcome, Matthew Stieb.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good, thank you. Secretary DeVos told the committee last week that they had to make some hard choices. Why did they have to make the hard choices? What's the problem?
You know, they've tried to cut these budgets for 2 years in a row now. And 2 years in a row, they haven't. Last year, they actually increased the budget. So it seems unclear why they're going after special education in this light. In addition to the $17.6 million cut that was rescinded by the president for the Special Olympics. Mm-hmm. There was a $7.5 million cut to the National Technical Institute for the Deaf, a $13 million cut to the Gallaudet University, which would bring federal funding down for that school for the deaf. And there was also a $5 million cut for the American Printing House for the Blind, which is a federal program that makes books for blind students.
And no one in her testimony did she explain why these were tough choices they had to make?
No, she was kind of skirting that issue. She was referring to the IDEA Act from 1975,
right.
Which is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and ensures that students with disabilities have the rights to go to school. Prior to the act, in some states, severely disabled students might not be able to enroll. And so she was saying that funding for that was still high. Mark Pocan, a representative from Wisconsin, was grilling her on that, and she was trying to get her to answer about the specific cuts. She mostly deferred to speaking about IDEA.
Right. I mean, IDEA still is not fully funded. It was supposed to be, it was known at the time as 94-142 as well. It was supposed to be funded at 40%, leaving the rest of the states and the local districts, but it's never even come close, right?
Right. I believe in reality it's around 14%.
Mm-hmm.
And special needs education advocates are really pushing to get up to that 40. That would be a huge victory to get what IDEA wants. And so even in well-off communities, parents and teachers of special needs students feel they're not getting the funding necessary to provide a proper education. So in school districts that are poor or in which students of color make up a large population of the schools, that need is much greater.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about special education today in light of the kerfuffle last week when testimony by Secretary Betsy DeVos, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, drew attention to cuts to Special Olympics. As my guest, Matthew Stieb, he's a staff writer for the New York Magazine. He covered that testimony last week. And as he's just told us, more than $17 million was cut, or $7.5 million was cut from the National Technical Institute for the Blind, $13 million from Gallaudet University, $5 million else, you know, a total of how much cut from special education programs, Matthew?
Oh, that looks to be about $25 million total, which is such a small representation of the budget. I believe the budget cuts, the administration intended to cut $8.5 billion, around 12% of the current budget. So those cuts to special education represent, I believe, less than a percentage point.
In place of funding for after-school programs and grants to teachers, she wanted increased funding for charter schools and private school scholarships. Is this where people think she wanted to put the money?
Right. So I think Betsy DeVos, as Secretary of Education, represents the larger philosophy within the Trump administration to push the responsibility onto the private sector. She did propose a $5 billion grant that would allow private institutions to pay for, or that they would be subsidized for giving money to private schools. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a roundabout way of funding, because $5 billion is a lot of money.
Versus 25 yeah. million. And was
exactly.
was any of that $5 billion stipulated to be spent on special education? Because private schools right now, unless they're publicly funded charters, they don't have to take in special education students, right?
Right. I believe it was there were no stipulations on special mm-hmm. education money within that $5 billion.
What kind of reception? I mean, we already know that it got a lot of press. It really grabbed the headlines, the Special Olympics cuts did. But in general, how did Republicans and Democrats respond to this this next effort, or the second attempt to cut funding for special ed?
Right. It's really interesting. So these cuts have been attempted to be made the last 2 years as well. Mm-hmm. But because it's the House is now run by Democrats. This is in the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Education, where this testimony went down. And because Mark Pocan and others really grilled DeVos on these cuts, then they made their way into the press. In the press, they've been derided as unnecessary. Among parents of special education or special needs students, they're saying that it's really representative of the problem, that there's not enough money and not enough attention being paid in order to get proper education for these students.
How are the, it's obviously there's parents, but what's the lobby like for special education in Washington? Is it strong?
To be honest, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. And
sorry.
That's okay. And the states, I mean, so it was just the members of the committee that were grilling her. Was there any other response from any other communities?
It was mostly from the House and from special needs parents who came out with the strongest ones. It is interesting that President Trump has allowed Betsy DeVos to take this this heat. In private, he's expressed that she is, fairly expendable within the administration. So mm-hmm. it's interesting that she is willing to go up there and defend these cuts in a way that others within the administration have not been able to. She did say that she was pleased and grateful the president was decided to fund the Special Olympics grant. Mm-hmm. She said it was something that she's fought for behind the scenes over the last several years. And in 2017, she did donate a quarter of her salary to the Special Olympics.
Yes, and she did say that private philanthropy should take the lead with the Special Olympics.
Right. So that $17.6 million from the federal government only represents around 10% of the Special Olympics budget. And Politico reports actually that the Special Olympics expects to see an increase in private funding from all this because it was such a publicity boon. So it is also a roundabout way that the organization has gotten a little more funding.
So she's saying that behind the scenes she's been fighting for this funding, but in her testimony she defends it.
Correct, yes.
The cuts. How did she respond when President Trump took back the cuts?
So she went back in front of the House Appropriations Subcommittee and sort of played the face pretty well. She said that she was glad that the cuts were not going to happen, and defended the idea and the $5 billion for private institutions to donate to private schools. Mm-hmm. So she seems to be very committed to doing her job and what the president needs out of the Secretary of Education.
Well, why is he dissing her behind closed doors? What's going on with that?
I don't know. So in a Times report on the issue, they write that he considers her expendable, mm-hmm. And that there was possibility she was out of office after an injury a few weeks ago. Some White House officials expected that her absence could be used as an opportunity to replace her. That ultimately didn't happen. White House officials told the Times that Mr. Trump is not fond of her, and that he didn't have a problem making her appear to be the bad actor with this Special Olympics debacle. The White House denied that characterization on the record, but it appears that or Trump has privately also expressed that he's not particularly concerned with the Education Department. So it could be a synecdoche for that, that he is willing to put the blame on Betsy DeVos in order to take it away from himself and take blame on other issues.
Mm-hmm. And what's the next step? So this has gone through the House. The next, it then goes to the Senate, right?
It will go to the Senate, and I think it's important to remember that budget requests are often more of a wish list mm-hmm. than an expectation of an actual budget, because it will have to go back to the House after it goes to the Senate, I believe. So it's a long process, and there's a lot of room for these cuts to be dropped, and special education funding was not cut the last 2 years, despite the Trump administration pushing that goal for it to be cut.
Matthew Stieb, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you.
Matthew Stieb is an Intelligencer staff writer for New York Magazine. He covered Betsy DeVos's testimony last week for the House Budget Committee on funding cuts for special education. We're going to drill down a little bit deeper into the special education issue, what it means, who's entitled to it, and how much it costs and where we get the money from. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos last week testified about proposed cuts for Special Olympics, attracting a storm of criticism and a quick take back from President Trump. Still, several proposed cuts in the pending budget touch programs that directly and indirectly affect special needs students at a time when demand for special education services is increasing. Joining us now to shed some light on what special education encompasses in Ohio is Ohio State University Associate Professor of Special Education, and she researches improving academic outcomes for those with learning disabilities. Terry Hessler, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also, Paulo DiMaria is a superintendent of public instruction for the Ohio Department of Education, and he joins us by phone. Welcome back, Paulo.
And great to be with you.
The states for years have protested that the Education for All Students law passed in 1975 has been an unfunded mandate. The federal government was originally supposed to get the funding to 40%. It's never come close to that. I guess it's about 14% now from the feds. What's the financial burden for the state of Ohio when it comes to special education? Paulo?
Well, Ann, you know, like so many things in public service, there's a shared responsibility. So right now, the state contributes relatively significantly to the education of students with disabilities. And I always want to make it clear that, you know, the way we fund education in Ohio, there's sort of like base cost funding. That's the funding amount that would follow any particular student. And then there's supplemental funding for students with disabilities. And if you include the whole array of different types of special supports for students with disabilities, it's over $1 billion. That starts with about $860 million that goes directly to school districts based on different categories. In Ohio, we look at different students and understand that even within the category of special students with disabilities, there are those that might carry a higher cost and those that carry a lower cost, and so that system drives that distribution of $860 million. But then we also have special ed funding in our joint vocational schools, as well as a number of other minor programs. Preschool special education is also over $100 million.
Terry Hessler, what we think of as a special ed student has changed a lot over the years since 1975. I think back then it seemed to be largely physically impaired and then to a certain degree developmentally impaired or delayed. But it's now we have the issue of the spectrum of autism and that kind of a thing that really wasn't even considered back then. Can you kind of describe who qualifies as a special education student these days?
Sure. Well, you're right. I think when most people think of special education, they tend to think of maybe students in wheelchairs and students with severe disabilities, the typical student they might think of in Special Olympics, when in fact, most students who receive special ed services receive them under the disability category of specific learning disabilities. There are 13 disability categories, according to the federal regulations. And specific learning disabilities that's the largest category. So approximately 13% of all school-age students in the nation receive special ed services. Of those 13%, about 35% are in special ed for learning disabilities. So the next largest category receive services under speech and language. And then the next largest receive them under other health impairments. And that's an interesting category because ADHD is classified under other health impairments. So a large percentage of other health impairments is because students are being diagnosed with ADHD in larger numbers. And then also emotional disorders, which those and high-functioning autism, those several categories are what we call high-incidence disabilities. The nomenclature often casually calls them invisible disabilities, where if you look at these students in a classroom, you wouldn't know they have a disability because they don't look any different than your kids without disabilities. And interestingly, these are the kids who will be in the general ed classrooms for 80% of their day.
The ones that are kind of mainstream,
correct,
as we think of, yeah.
Right, in the inclusive environments.
The demand for special education, Paula DeMaria, has increased over the years. What do we know about why that is?
You know, Anne, I'm not sure. Part of it's about better efforts at identification. So we're at about 14% of the students in public schools in Ohio as being identified as students with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, we've learned so much more about things like ADHD and autism and so forth and so on. I think we're getting better at understanding those circumstances. You know, to Terry's point, I think the other thing that people need to remember is that just because somebody has a disabling condition doesn't mean they can't learn, doesn't mm-hmm. mean that anything's wrong with their cognitive abilities. And I think that's also sometimes the challenge that we face is if people feel like somebody who is a student with disabilities, quote unquote, that means they actually just can't learn as well as other students. Just absolutely false. Sure, there are those students that have traumatic brain injury and those kinds of things that do in fact affect their ability to discover and learn and acquire knowledge and skills. But the vast majority of these students don't have those kinds of things. They have things that stand in the they have disabling conditions that stand in the way of their learning, but they have the capacity to learn, and I think mm-hmm. that's the challenge we face in the education system.
Right. I think Paolo's point is so important. It needs to be underscored that 80% of all students with disabilities are average to above average intelligence. I like to underscore that with my students, that trope of the I don't even like to say it out loud, and I use air quotes, that the slow student is a misnomer. Our students have
absolutely.
They learn differently. They aren't cognitively impaired, most of them.
It's kind of amazing, really, even when you look at cognitively impaired groups, how amazing it is how the advances we've made. Say, let's just take the broad category of people who are born with Down syndrome. Their expectations for them now versus 40 years ago are off the charts now.
Absolutely. We are, in fact, sometimes we become immune to the outcomes that there are foundational longitudinal studies that are kind of dismal, actually, for outcomes with students with disabilities as young adults. But we're a model for the world here in this country as far as outcomes for students with individuals with disabilities. We stand as a model. We have individuals from other countries coming to our universities here in this country to learn how to be special educators and then go back and start special education in their countries.
You know, but that does raise the issue of what a special educator is, because now we've just described a universe that's expanding and changing. And then we have the special educator, special education teachers who are specially educated. They cost more to educate, and they're expected to do more than ever before. Paulo Di Maria, what do we know about the funding for teachers and the shortages, particularly for special kinds of therapists, audio, audiology, speech, that kind of a thing?
Well, there are a number of things embedded in this question. First and foremost, I think, you know, the ideal setting for a student with disabilities is in the regular classroom. So more and more our emphasis is making sure that regular teachers understand how do they need to differentiate their instructional practices in order to address the needs of students with disabilities and work collaboratively with intervention specialists and helping ensure successful outcomes for these kinds of students. So, in fact, we're seeing a number of our colleges of education emphasize that sort of integrating what you might normally teach to someone who's going into be an intervention specialist or a special education teacher, and make sure that knowledge is also part of the development and preparation of regular classroom teachers, because it's so important. And in fact, we're being measured by the federal government and ourselves. About how much inclusion there is. How much time do those students with disabilities spend in the regular classroom? So the importance of having a regular classroom teacher understand those strategies, as well as knowing how to work with an intervention specialist that may also be in their classroom, it's really, really important. You know, at the same time, as you said, Ian, you know, we continue to look for ways to, you know, make the teaching profession attractive and attract people into it. And I think a lot of people are called by virtue of helping students with disabilities, and we just need to leverage that that vocation and continue to pursue successful strategies that allow teachers and educators to be successful.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Paulo Di Maria. He's superintendent of public instruction for the state of Ohio. Also with us, Terry Hessler. She's an associate professor of special education at Ohio State. If you have a question or comment, we'd like to hear from parents who have worked through this system. Hear what you have to say about it, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about special education today, what it is and what it costs to provide it to people who are entitled to it by federal law. 614-292-8513. Matthew Steeb from the New York Magazine mentioned that disproportionately poor districts and heavy minority districts, people of color, districts that educate majority people of color, tend to be disproportionately represented in the special education community. What do we know about why that is, Terry Hessler?
Well, there's a disconnect between the majority population in teaching and that population, a cultural disconnect, cultural capital disconnect. So that's one probably pretty big factor. And I teach about that in my classes, that the best thing we can do for our cultural responsiveness as teachers is to get to know the individuals in our classes and understand how best they function as students, but then to understand the culture at large in which our students function. So that goes a long way in understanding how best to respond to student behaviors in our class. Mm-hmm. So we know that, for instance, African-American boys are overrepresented in the emotional and behavioral disorder category at a rate of 2-1 of white boys. That's not because they have emotional or behavioral disorders at a rate of 2-1. That's an obvious problem with referrals and identification that system. So we need to...
There's an implicit bias in there somewhere. Okay,
yes.
Gotcha. And what does it do, Paulo Di Maria, to the funding for schools when we're already talking about, you know, underfunding? Just the fact of the matter is poor schools need more money. And when they have these disproportionate needs as well, what does that do?
Well, again, I think to Terry's point, the actual manifestation of disproportionality doesn't necessarily mean that that's correct. And in fact, you know, Anne, there are so many areas in education that we apply ourselves to continuously looking for ways to get better and better. Mm-hmm. I commend Terry for her point, because the more teachers are really tuned into their own cultural competency and are educated in that regard, I think that's one of the solutions to the issue of over-identification. I also think that we generally, as an education community, have to get better in understanding how to improve the learning experiences for students with disabilities, including such things as, you know, are we properly identifying whether a student has a disability or not? And then what are the things that we do to make sure we're differentiating instruction in the classroom or understanding the cultural realities that students bring with them to the classroom?
So
yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was thinking, just for example, let's take the boy who's referred for emotional disability issues. He could be hungry. He could be coming from a dysfunctional household. It's not that he's the problem.
Right.
It's something else.
And the other issue is that...
but you still have to deal with
the
problem.
And our high minority... I don't like to use the word minority anymore, but our high poverty and urban systems also tend to have more novice teachers. They tend to get less skilled and higher turnover. And even I was just reading about how even when their more affluent districts are filling their positions, there are positions that are going open in more urban, higher need districts, especially in special education. So they're not getting...
Paulo?
Yeah, the other thing, you know, so I know you're familiar with our recently adopted strategic plan that really has meeting the needs of the whole child at the center. And I think increasingly across the board, we're seeing many, many more schools paying attention to what are those needs. Is it a student coming to class hungry? Is it a student coming to class having experienced trauma in their home life or what have you? And then what can the school do in partnership with other community partners, right? There's so many entities and organizations in our cities and towns that have as part of their mission serving the needs of kids. How do we bring those together? In fact, the governor's budget proposal, and I really salute Governor DeWine for this, it really focuses on providing extra resources to deliberately help schools identify the kinds of supports that students need and partnering with local, whether it's the local mental health board, the local health department, other entities that have helping children succeed as part of their mission to work in the schools meeting the needs of the whole child in exactly the way you described.
Meeting the needs of the whole child starts if we know that there's a disability at birth for some. Terry Hussler, is the school district responsible for that at birth?
And Paulo might be able to speak to this better. That's a little out of my area, but there's state of Ohio has Child Find, and actually that's federal, that school districts are responsible for identifying children who have disabilities. Paulo, is that right, from birth?
Yeah, although our system of developmental disabilities, so we have the State Department of Developmental Disabilities as well as various county DD boards that have responsibility for the 0 to 3students.
And I wondered if that is an issue in the education of children with special needs, the fact that it goes from one agency to another. It's not continuous with an agency.
Well, you know, we have a very close working relationship with the Department of Developmental Disabilities. Director Davis and I have known each other for years and are very committed to the necessary collaboration to ensure that not only are there seamless transitions between our system or their system and ours, you know, but that we're closely working on the shared agenda of what is it we have to do collectively to ensure student success. In fact, I recently convened a working group that's focused on improving the learning experiences and outcomes for students with disabilities. Because as we look at, to Terry's point, even though we may be a model for the world, there's still room for improvement.
Absolutely.
In terms of the outcomes that we achieve with students with disabilities. And I said to my staff, I said, I really want to bring together practitioners and teachers and parents and people from the higher education community to really kind of roll up our and better understand what are the challenges that face us in terms of improving those academic outcomes. And the Department of Developmental Disabilities is included in that process because they are an essential partner in the work.
I think a more central problem is than early childhood might be that, and Paula's mentioned this a couple of times, is that because so many of our students with disabilities are included in the general ed classroom, we have a problem in teacher training programs in higher ed that general ed students aren't required to take science-based special education preparation programs. So they're going into general ed classrooms to teach general education, mm-hmm. and they're having students with special needs in their classrooms, and they're not prepared to teach them. They may take special ed classes, but they're not required to take special ed classes that teach them how to teach those students. They mm-hmm. may take special ed classrooms that talk about the philosophy of special ed or the philosophy of labeling.
Who sets the requirements?
Paolo.
Are you saying he does it, or are you asking?
I'm asking him to answer that question.
Yeah. Who sets those requirements, Paolo Di Maria?
Well, in some respects, we have to do it collectively, right? We have to bring the teaching, and many of the colleges of education are already ahead of state policy in terms of understanding that teachers increasingly, because they work very closely with their districts, teachers are increasingly finding many students with disabilities in their classrooms, so they understand that their graduates need to have the competencies in that area. The Department of Higher Education also plays a role in terms of program approval for colleges of education. And so usually what happens is at about this point in the process where people understand that there's a real disconnect or an apparent disconnect, and some colleges are already doing work in there, it's time to bring everybody together and have that conversation. And it also speaks to Terry's point about cultural competency, right, because that's another contributing factor. Also trauma-informed practices. Some of these things that we see emerging in terms of best practices on the educational front are things that we need to ensure with some consistency are happening across the teacher preparation spectrum.
I'm going to grab a quick call now. Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Mm-hmm. I was wondering how much of these programs help train the parents to cope? Because I have a friend who's been here in Columbus all her life. Her child was born with cerebral palsy, is one step short of legally blind, with even with corrective lenses, and is slightly crippled. He can walk, but he has a limping gait. Mm-hmm. And has had multiple surgery at children throughout his childhood.
Okay, so at what point do the parents, Terry Hessler, how do we approach that when it comes to helping parents help their children?
Well, the early childhood 0 to 3 programming is directed at the families. So the childhood school age programs are individual education programs, IEPs, that you might have heard about, but mm-hmm. the early childhood are individual family service plans.
Okay.
So those programming needs are directed towards the families. And then after they leave the family-based plans, the students go on the individual education plans. And I'm not...
My parents are usually involved in that process.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Charlotte, thanks for that call.
I also think, Ann, to the same issue. You mm-hmm. know, I think both the people that work in this area and at the county boards of developmental disabilities and in school districts understand that parents, it's a very emotional issue for parents.
Yeah.
And so I think they go to lengths to help parents understand the different, technical aspects of the process and what it means for their children in different settings try to create the, connectivity, connections, and good communications. And we continue to try to get better and better at that all the time. There are also some advocacy organizations in Ohio. The Coalition for the Education of Students with Disabilities is a wonderful organization that has a long history in Ohio as an advocate for students with disabilities. They produce a lot of literature and pamphlets, and they have staff on hand that can support parents. Disability Rights Ohio is another organization. Mm-hmm. People understand that. At the same time, we also understand that it's a very complicated area, and we may not always do a great job, but we're constantly looking for ways to improve and make sure, because a parent has to be a critical partner and an essential partner in the development of the plans, whether it's the service plan or the individualized education plan, the IEP, which is what happens when they get into the pre-K-12 system, mm-hmm. and they're essential partners in helping children become successful.
And the legacy of special ed in our country is built on family advocacy. It all happened because families. We know about the Kennedys and right. Special Olympics and that, but it really started before that with the grassroots movements of families. So they've been a part of it from the very start.
Paolo Di Maria, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Always happy to do it, Ann.
Paolo Di Maria, Superintendent of Public Instruction in the state of Ohio. Terry Hessler, Associate Professor of Special Education at Ohio State, will stay with us. Coming up, we're going to hear from, someone who works with teachers on these issues. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Federal funding for special education took center stage last week after Education Secretary Betsy DeVos stirred up controversy over proposed funding cuts. She had proposed in her budget eliminating funding to Special Olympics, among other programs, and the backlash forced President Trump to walk that proposal back very quickly. But a number of other cuts to the budget directly and indirectly impact students with special needs. So that's what we're talking about today. Still with us is OSU Associate Professor of Special Education, Terry Hessler. She studies how to improve academic outcomes for students with learning disabilities. Also joining us by phone is Director of Government Relations for the National Education Association, Mark Egan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be with you.
Let's talk about education, special education funding and what kind of stake something like the NEA, which represents teachers, has in properly funding it.
Sure. So we have long advocated at the National Education Association that Congress live up to its commitment to fully fund the special education law. And it's been well over 40 years since Congress created this program. Mm-hmm. That's all about giving more opportunity to try to provide a good education for children with disabilities. And the track record of Congress is just abysmal. The Congress recognized when they created the law that it costs more to educate children with disabilities and said that they would help states and local communities by funding up to 40% of the cost. Mm-hmm. They have never funded even half that amount. And the last couple of years, under the leadership of Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary, we have actually been backsliding, and we're actually lower than 14% right now of the federal share. And the impact that has, obviously, on students with disabilities, but really all students, is harmful, because you're then forcing states and local school districts to make up for that gap. And the gap is astonishing. This year alone, it's a $23 billion gap that Congress should be providing in resources for states and local school districts. And actually, for the state of Ohio, it's actually almost $800 million that the Congress should be sending to the state to help fund education for children with disabilities.
Hmm. We've talked earlier in the program about how back in 75, when they passed the 94-142, the universe of conditions that qualified somebody for special education was much smaller than it is today, right? I mean, the need has expanded, at least our awareness of a need.
Without question. And, this is actually something that we should be proud of as a country. I mean, there's much more, early diagnosis of issues. Educators and other professionals are trained to try to spotlight early challenges that students are having, whether it's, autism, whether it's learning disabilities, things of that nature. And so, yes, there more and more students are being identified, and the needs are great. The need to the direction of IDEA, which was a positive one of trying to have the least restrictive environment educationally for students with disabilities, mainstreaming where we can, is a positive thing. It's something that this country should be very proud of. We want every child to have a great opportunity, but it is completely short-sighted and hypocritical, really, of Congress to say that on the one hand and say we're going to provide extra resources to help local school districts provide these services to students, and then fall so woefully short. And it's not a surprise right now with Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary. To be quite clear, she just does not get it when it comes to providing a good education, not only for children with disabilities, but anyone in our public schools. I mean, she has been all about for-profit charter schools, which we know is a huge problem in Ohio, and private school vouchers. And so, you know, we on the other hand are looking at Congress to try to basically get things right. And IDEA funding, special education funding, historically has actually had support from both Democrats and Republicans. And so we're making a real push this year, especially to try to turn things around and start closing that gap that Congress has had for so many years.
Getting to a little bit to the point that our caller made a few minutes ago regarding how parents are, you know, counseled and how they're prepared to cope with having a special needs child. A friend of mine has two autistic children. She says she gets most of her information in waiting rooms at doctor's offices and in waiting rooms at where their kids when their kids are undergoing trials and stuff like that for medication. That's where the people who really make the most of the federal laws and the funding available for parents and everything from respite to, you know, special training that they don't get it necessarily from the school district. And I'm wondering if we do a good enough job, Terry Hessler, making that connection.
Well, and I go back to the point that most students with these high incidence disabilities are being educated for a large part of their day in a classroom in which their teachers aren't prepared to educate them. And again, I don't blame the teachers. It's, if anything, I'm pointing the fingers back at me in higher ed that we're not preparing these teachers to teach these students. And as far as the funding cuts go, funding cuts affect higher ed in the research area, which is where we're getting the information. And that's why parents are getting the information in the waiting rooms is because that's where the research is happening.
Funding cuts affect you, too.
Yes, they do. An enormous amount. That's where we're getting the information is from our research.
And then I think, Mark Egan, about the training that teachers need. Terry was just talking about, you know, regular classroom teachers need extra training as well to identify and then deal with special education students. But, most teachers want to get a master's degree anyway so they can make more money. Special education teachers automatically have to get a master's degree.
Not anymore.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. It's been a while. I mean, I don't know how long, but.
Is there enough training money going to teachers, Mark Egan?
No, not even close. And I agree with what Terry said. I mean, I think, and the reality is it's very uneven across this country. There are some school districts, not nearly enough, that actually do a really great job. And you mentioned children with autism. My son is 10 years old. He's on the autism spectrum. We've been very fortunate, the school district that we are part of, they have great educators who have clearly had a lot of training and support. We have paraeducators who work seamlessly with the classroom teacher. That is the way it should be done. That is not what happens, though, in most school districts in this country. And to Terry's point about training and professional development, that is vastly needed, not just by special education teachers and paraeducators, but, as you said, by general education teachers as well. There needs to be that coordination, and that speaks to not only the teacher prep programs that Terry was referencing, but once the educators are in the classroom, ongoing, meaningful professional development that is driven by educators, not kind of a cookie-cutter approach that comes down from a school district where there's not enough funding for it. And there's a federal government role in this, too. There's the Title II program, which is actually a couple billion dollars, is all about professional development for educators and also about reducing class sizes. And Betsy DeVos wants to zero out that program. She has called 3 years in a row to eliminate all funding for that program. So, again, we do not have an education secretary right now who is helping to make public education better. She is doing things in the exact opposite direction. And so the impact that we have, that we see on our students and also that you see then on state and local budgets, which are already strained, is made that much worse. And that's obviously the opposite direction of where we need to be going as a country.
Carrie in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there. Thanks for covering this topic.
Sure.
It really hits home for me because I'm a certified teacher in special ed in elementary, and I came out in 98 right after the National Reading Panel studied all kinds of reading programs and looking for evidence-based, scientifically proven strategies. And it's taken a long time for higher ed or whoever's implementing those what has been found as effective, because in 2004 I graduated with a master's in reading education, and still I hadn't heard about dyslexia until I went to a learning center here in Columbus, where they talk about dyslexia and provide a reading method or teaching method called Orton-Gillingham.
Mm-hmm.
It's a specialized program, but there are companies who are providing large classroom programs to help kids learn in this multi-sensory systematic way. And it works for all kids, so it needs to be in the classroom and not a special thing.
Well, you know, I want to turn to Terry Hessler real quick, because as you were talking, Terry was nodding her head in understanding that she gets what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Terry.
I'm an Orton-Gillingham credentialed intervention specialist as well. And we know that that's what works for individuals with dyslexia, is that approach. And the story is long and it is tough. And NPR, in fact, has a wonderful series about the problem with reading instruction in higher ed. So I'm sure that Anne could probably put a link to the series,
sure,
in her show notes,
yeah,
that covers that. And in fact, 90% of all of the students who are in special ed because of learning disabilities are in special ed because they struggle with reading. So
yeah,
we are not doing a good job of teaching our students to read in the public school system. So yes, Carrie, people who know me are thinking that I put you in the call list.
You're
as a plant,
Carrie.
But no,
good,
I didn't.
Thanks for your
But
call.
Yes, that's a big problem.
And then real quick, Steve in Cincinnati, I wanted to grab you real quick. Go ahead.
No. You and I usually talk about other topics, but this one gets a little close to home to me.
Hi,
Steve. Hi, man. I was a freshman in 75 and graduated with a teaching and math degree in 79. So the whole federal law was fresh stuff back then. And then I ended up getting on the board of a coalition of groups with disabilities. And it seemed like we spent a lot of our time advising our clients, parents, on how to fight with school districts who didn't want to implement the law and didn't want to spend the money. So I'm curious, 40 years later, are those fights still ongoing? Do parents have resources to help
let's hear.
And school districts?
Steve Magus, hang on a second. I want to hear what Mark Egan has to say from the National Education Association. Mark Egan?
So, no, it's a great question, Steve. I mean, again, I think it's uneven around the country. I think some school districts do a better job than others on that. You know, again, as a parent of a child with special needs, we've been through our own personal IEP team meetings with the school staff and with our child. And, you know, districts do work hard to follow the law and make sure the parents are being are receiving the information that they're supposed to receive under the law. The reality sometimes is it can be complicated. It's obviously a very personal thing for parents to be going through with your children wanting to get a great education, whether they're a typical student or child with disabilities. And so it can be a bit of a maze, and I think sometimes school district officials have to also be careful, because they need to make sure that they're not doing or saying something that's going to lead to a lawsuit. So it's an imperfect system. I think it's probably vastly better than it was many, many years ago, but there's still much room for improvement. And again, I think it's probably very uneven around the country.
Hmm. Mark Egan, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Ann.
Mark Egan is Director of Government Relations for the National Education Association. And Terry Hessler, Associate Professor of Special Education at Ohio State, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We will put a link to that NPR series about the reading program on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have to dig it up first, but we'll find it and we'll get it there for you. Thanks to everybody for your calls. Thanks for your attention today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.